Hey then, this is Seth Warris from Channel 9 at the beautiful Cambridge office, Microsoft offices here in Cambridge, where a lot of data science happens. And I'm here with a special guest. Why don't you tell us who you are and what you do, bud?
My name is George Iordanescu. I'm a data scientist with the Algorithm and Data Science Group in Boston, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We do lots of data science projects here. We are facing external clients. Mm-hmm. There is another data science group, but they are only for internal. Mm-hmm. So we work with different clients from different industries, manufacturing, energy, financial, payments. So a large variety of projects. And one of the focuses of my team is IoT projects.
Okay.
Where you have lots of sensors today, and in the future there'll be even more. Lots of sensors that record signals over time, over long periods of time, and that this brings a set of specific challenges to the data.
Yeah, and so here's the thing, like any IoT project I've ever seen creates this sort of data exhaust, and it's continuous and it's voluminous, and these things start to fill up hard drives. And I've always wondered how do you deal with data that big? Data that no longer fits in RAM and no longer fits on hard drives. What are some of the challenges that happen with that?
Yeah, there are two main challenges. One is the data ingestion and storage. That's one thing. And second is how do you analyze this data?
Right.
So both are, you know, big and important challenges. Microsoft has solutions like the IoT Hub for data ingestion and storage. It even has solutions for streaming analytics, so you can analyze the data as it comes in, including calling machine learning models, mm-hmm. So that's very cool. But in the end, the other big challenge is you have the data, it's stored. You don't always have to process it online, at least for the modeling part. You have
sure.
to have access to the full history. So we have lots of sensors recorded over long periods of time, and you know, you have to understand what data is telling you. And so because there are very many and they're recorded over many long periods of time, it's not important to describe the full sensor. If you say the range of this sensor over the last year was this and the average was this and the standard deviation was that, it describes the sensor but is useless because you want to know how it changed,
right?
Or whether there was a change. So you really have to look at certain windows in time and see how the statistics of the signal changed as the window moved in time. And then you have a chance to say, hey, you know, the first 3 months it was at a certain level and then the pattern changed and here is where the change happened and this is important for us. So
let me see if I'm understanding right. So you have this sort of end data points, which orders on millions, billions of rows, because these things, let's just say the sensor pops out every second, right?
Yeah.
Then if you have sensor data for a year and then you have 1,000 devices, you're talking about a lot of rows, right? So you're telling me that clearly you can't work on all the data at once. It doesn't even fit on a hard drive.
Even if you could, so first of all, you cannot, indeed.
Yeah.
But even if you could, it's useless because you don't want to describe one column. Even if you could,
yeah.
It's that column, if you just describe it, it's plain statistics, like I said, how the signal looked like, the average, the range and stuff, that information is not useful. You need to understand how the statistics change in time.
I see.
You need to say what was the local minimum 1 month ago, 2 months ago, 3 months ago. So that minimum, how it changed, that's the important signal or the important information, not overall the minimum.
And so then the second thing you said that was interesting is that you start to have to sort of look at windows of the data instead of all of the data at once. So a couple of questions. The first one is, how do you know how fine-grained that window needs to be, number one? And number two, what if you're starting to look at sort of aggregates of data that may require the looking at the first record and the last record, and then you're working with windows? So the first question is, how do you know the window size, and then how do you look at data from different windows together?
The question is, there is no clear answer,
yeah.
So you have to try. So you need the ability to have a window that slides across the signal in time. Mm-hmm. And of course, the different aggregation level, you understand this is too much, this is too little. But the point is, you need such a mechanism. You cannot just, even if you could, you cannot just describe the full statistics of the full sensor in time. So you need a mechanism to describe how this thing changed. And the challenge is not necessarily combining the first with the last. That's, let's say, classical. Mm-hmm. The challenge is within a row, you're looking at row 1 million, you need to define what happened over a window around that row. So we need the previous 100 and the previous 100, the 100 rows after that.
Yeah.
You need a window of 200 windows to understand what happened there. So the challenge is for each row that you are issuing a response or computing something, you actually need to look at the neighbors of the, surrounding that row, which may happen before and after.
So it feels like you're effectively taking this one huge data set and making n data sets that are a width L or whatever window.
Yeah.
And each of those, is each of those windows going to have their own model, or are you going to model everything on a set of windows? So this is where I'm a little confused.
This window essentially becomes your unit. That will be the that will give you a signature, a feature, if you want. So you want to see how this, the property of the signal over this window, how they look now, and you compare this with how it looked later or before. And this is essentially the information you look at, rather than each individual row, you look at how the properties of the window change in time.
I see. So what you're saying is, instead of having rows of single data, what you're doing is you're scrunching together a window, and then that now becomes your signal.
Correct.
And so the question that you said it depends is, how big should that window be? What are some sort of heuristics that one should look at and say, I could make it this big or that big?
It's all use case dependent, and you need subject matter expertise, and you can also look at the data to see what happened. You need advice from engineers or whoever knows the system where the important pieces are. Mm-hmm. But the other important thing is the interplay. So you need to see how these sensors looked when another sensor had a certain value, and then how this sensor looked when the other sensor had switched the value. So rather than just looking at how the window changed in time, mm-hmm. you want to compare the windows of this signal when one valve is off and the windows of this signal when the other valve is on. Mm-hmm. This comparison is much more important and descriptive of your data, rather than saying, this is how the window changed for this signal, this is how the window changed for this signal. Mm-hmm. If you pair them, there was high pressure in this pattern when the valve is on, and low value and this pattern when the valve is off, that's more significant. That describes your data in a more comprehensive way than just taking two columns independently. So it's the multivariate nature of the data that you need to capture.
So you're trying to find the correlation in the windows as well.
Could be correlation. It's actually statistics are dependent on the other amplitudes. If you think of a binary value like a valve on and off, you want to see average or minimum or whatever, how it changed when that was off and when it was on. Not necessarily correlation, but I want to report the signal when this was on and the signal when this was off. And this is the information you need for modeling. Not necessarily correlation, but you do need to take into account the multivariate nature of the data.
I see. And so when you're saying, are you talking about like when a specific feature is on or when a specific feature is off? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. It could be a sensor that is binary on and off, or it can be multiple levels. If you look at aircraft data during a flight, you have multiple phases. When you take off, when you are in the air, when you land. So all these different phases, they have different features. So it doesn't make sense to report how the altitude or the pressure changed over the whole flight, but you need to say it changed like this when it was landing, it changed like this when it was in air, and you need to separate by different phases. So the other sensor can be binary or multi-level.
I see. So you're saying that you not only do you do the windows, but you also do it by phase as well.
Yeah, and the phase is defined by a different sensor.
Right, okay.
In which in data science is a different column.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. So now that I have all this data, and now that I start to have the windows, and now that I start to have the phases, what do I do with that? I mean, are we making new features effectively that are aggregates of other features?
Yeah. So you can, let's say an important signature will be how the distribution changed along this window in these two phases, or in the phases, different phases of the, let's say, of the aircraft. Mm-hmm. You can describe the distribution using, let's say, quantiles or range or average or amplitudes, you know, different amplitudes. But the features that are actually fed into the model are how they changed in time. So you can get multiple rows. This window, this is how it was with that particular binary value, the valve. And another row, this a second window with that amplitude and so on. So this new data can be fed into a model and say, when this particular pattern of the window happened with that particular valve, we had this event, failure or non-failure. And we had this pattern and that valve, then there was a different event. So the model can learn how to separate the patterns and predict, after it's trained, predict failures.
That's interesting, because now each window, because before we were like, hey, this window is going to aggregate into one row, but now you're saying it might aggregate into three rows because there's three phases, for example.
Yes, either three rows, or you can say this window with its feature and the value of that of the other column was zero, or this feature and the value was one or two. So it can be multiple rows, or it can be whatever happened there.
I see. So now that we've done that, I feel like you still might end up with data that won't fit into RAM. For example, if using R or Python, these things are running in memory.
It's more than that. It you may not be able to do it beforehand because the data is too huge.
Sure.
You cannot do it. And if you manage to do it, you may still, after you aggregate the data, you may still have issues processing in memory. So it's reaching this phase where you have these features over windows and multivariate nature, how to do it. And even after that, you may still have lots of data.
So what do we do then?
So that's where you need distributed computing, or at least an out-of-memory concept. So you can either bring chunks of data from the disk or from a different computer into the memory, into the RAM, to the processor to do processing, and then save it back. Or you can do a distributed computing framework where the data is separated into different computers, different nodes, and you push the computation onto the nodes rather than bring the data to the where the processing happens.
So I've heard that if you ever have a problem and then you use distributed systems, now you have two problems.
That's correct.
Right? So the question is, how do you do this in a reliable way, first of all? And the second and probably more important question are, what are sort of the distributed systems problems that you're going to run into, specifically when we're working with window data, and then these data are in different locations, I'm talking node-wise or even machine-wise?
Yeah. The good answer is that essentially you don't have to care. The bad part is that you still have to manage your chunks, so you need to understand the data is chunked and you can have access to the current row in the current chunk, and you can understand whether you need rows from other chunks.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have to manage this.
Sure.
But the beauty with the Microsoft R Server is that it allows you to switch very easily between the local context, the PEMA, so the out of memory, still local, but you bring data to the processor, mm-hmm. or fully distributed using Spark or Hadoop.
Okay.
So this is not 100% there, but it's very close, and it will be, you know, much better in the future. So essentially, whatever implementation is behind, it will be hidden from you. You don't have to care for it. You'll just focus on what you want to do, and the same code, just by switching the context, will run in memory on the local or out of memory, but still local, or distributed using Hadoop or Spark.
So
the beauty is that, you know, you'll not have to care how it's actually done. You just have to understand that data is chunked and you have to manage, but exactly the details will be hidden. So
I love it. So and effectively, we have this tool, R Server, that's supposed to help us with the distributed part. But at the same time, if we run an R script on a little test data set that does fit in memory, that same R script will work in the distributed sense.
Correct.
It feels a little magical. Do you have like an example you can show us?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's do it. All right.
Okay.
Ready?
So, yep.
Okay, so we talked a little bit over there, but we really didn't sort of write down like how the chunking is happening. So why don't you show us what we've got here and sort of go back to the discussion we had earlier.
Yeah, so this is the essence of what you want in IoT. it doesn't cover the chunking or the big data aspect, but it covers what you actually want as a data scientist. You have a signal that has a certain pattern when another sensor has a certain amplitude, like one, mm-hmm. and then when the other sensor amplitude drops to zero, then you have a different pattern, this one. So the pattern on the left is for the binary amplitude of a different sensor at level one, and then the pattern on the right is when the other sensor is at a level of zero. So this is simulated data, so you can control, you know, whatever you want, but in real life you don't have the luxury to look at the data individually and see how it looks. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do I capture such an aspect of the data when the data is big?
So let me see if I can clarify here. So this is just one sensor that's spitting out data, but it turns out that, for example, the sensor at this point in time is during high tide, and this point in time is during low tide, for example.
Correct.
So you know that there's going to be other signals that are going to happen during these other settings, right? But it's still the same signal.
Yeah. You want to understand whether this single signal changes behavior when other signals have different amplitudes.
Got it.
You don't know, but if it happens, you want to be able to capture that.
Got it. And so this is the raw data at the top.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. It's raw simulated data, and I simulated two behaviors just to show that we can capture it.
Got it.
So from this raw data, one sensor that changes behavior based on the amplitudes of another sensor, what you want is actually a window, which is this yellow rectangle that moves in time. So, you know, this is the first window, and then you move it a bit to the right, and then even more, and so on. So this window slides in time, and you want to capture the, distribution of this signal while this window changes. And of course, when the other signal changes amplitude from one to zero, you want to fill a different bucket of columns, because that gives you a different set of features.
I see.
So the multivariate nature of the signal comes is driven by the amplitude of the second sensor, the binary one, and the windowing feature comes from the fact that this is a continuous variable, and you want to see how it changes in time. And again, there is nothing here about big data. This is just pure data science. This is what you want to capture.
So before, I was mistakenly thinking that this windowing might actually make the data smaller, but it could be the case where at window one, you're looking at like the previous five and the next five, but at window two, you're only a previous five. So you could end up with a windowed function or windowed data that has the same amount of data points as you originally had.
Correct. It's
okay.
It's a choice whether you slide this window just by one sample, and then you get exactly the same amount of rows after processing as the original one.
I see.
Or you slide it by, you know, multiple rows, or even the number of rows in the window, and then you have completely non-overlapping windows.
Ah, I see. And so it's up to you whether they are overlapping or they're not overlapping, but it could be a scenario where you have the same amount of data you started with as far as rows is concerned.
Correct, yeah. If you just slide by one row, then you'll end up with as many windows as rows you have in the original data.
I see. And the point of this matter is to take, because the signal that you're getting is literally, there's two signals. There's a, is it on or off, and then what's the value? And you're making that into sort of a bigger, you're adding features to that in the end.
Yeah, you describe what happened to the signal not at the row level at one moment in time, but what happened over a certain period, local period of time.
And that might be more descriptive and better to do analysis on.
Yeah, yeah.
So what does a function look like in R where, because I'm guessing you're going to have the start row and the end row, and you're going to do some kind of math. Can you show us some of what that looks like?
Sure. So there are two issues here. One is the windowing per se, which is straightforward in, you know, any computer, any program can do that. But the extra complication comes from the data being big, so it's chunked. It's separated into different nodes. So what you have to do when you build such a function, you can compute such a variable like this one, like the beginning of each window, but you can use predefined variables or functions that you in MRS start with Rx, and the variable start with a dot. So such a variable is already implemented by MRS, and this gives you the first row in the current chunk.
Ah.
So based on what your needs are. You know, for I need the windows to start at 100 row, 200 row, and you know, row 300, and I need to add 50 before and after. You can understand based on where the current chunk began whether you need to go back to the to another node, to the previous chunk, and add more rows, or to the next row, next chunk in the, again on a different node and bring no more rows. So you have access to these predefined, implemented, already implemented functions in MRS that allows you to understand what, you know, what other rows you need.
So MRS is Microsoft R Server, correct?
Correct, Microsoft R Server. Yes.
And you got you have to tell it. Do you have where do you? How does these values get filled in? RX start row, etc.
They are provided. So you use them. I'm calling this variable and this number that I get by. Whenever, if I say here A equals RX start row, in A I'll store the beginning of the current chunk. So I just call it, I just use it.
And how do you tell it what the chunk sizes are? Does it, how does it know?
The chunk size is a property of the data. There are functions that allow you to rearrange data if you want in chunks. Mm-hmm. You can control that. But in general, the whole idea of this, especially for very large data sets, the whole idea is that you don't control that. Data is so huge. It's stored somewhere, you don't control how it was, mm-hmm. and it's difficult to recopy or you know move it. Mm-hmm. So that's a feature of the data. You have access to it using these variables, but it's sometimes it's not possible to change them.
Got it. So then the next question is, I see that you're given these values, but what happens when you're at point N, right, and you need N minus one, to do the aggregation, and say your window's 3, and then you need N plus 1, but N plus 1 is on a different machine. Do you have to tell it about that?
Yeah. So you can compute how many rows from a different chunk you need, and then again you use predefined functions like this function, rx read xdf, which is part of this package, RevoScale R, mm-hmm. which is a package in Microsoft R Server. And this allows you to actually go and read a certain number of rows from a different chunk. You don't have to care where those rows are in what chunk. You just need to say, I want to read from this row, from row 7, you know, whatever number of rows I want, and mm-hmm. MRS knows on which chunk to go and how many to read from there.
So in the N plus 1 case, it would find that chunk. You would get the one row you need, do the aggregation, and then continue on along your way.
Yeah.
And on the next one, you would be at N plus 1. You would need to get from the previous chunk, put it in, and then get the... Okay, that makes sense. So here's another question and something that maybe I just noticed. It looks like you're doing this in a separate virtual machine. Why don't you tell us about what that is?
Correct. These are essentially over-the-counter correspondents. So they are plain computers that are in the cloud. They are secure. They allow you to work, you know, for a client in an encapsulated way. You can choose to scale them before you start. So you can scale them to keep them low in resources when you don't have a lot of computation. Mm-hmm. You can stop them when you don't use them, so you don't incur costs. Or you can scale them the processor and the memory. You can scale them up right mm-hmm. before you start them. And you can connect them to an external storage account that will be shown as a drive. In this particular case, I mount an external storage account as a Z drive. I'm loading that right now. So this one, what I see here as a Z drive, is actually on a storage account in the cloud where I can store all my data, all my code, and that information will stay there even after I destroy the virtual machine. So it's totally separated. I can access it using regular storage accounts applications, and you know it keeps them completely separated. So I can scale as I wish the virtual machine, mm-hmm. and I can decide here how much memory I want and how I store it. And so everything is totally decoupled,
and
it gives you flexibility.
So effectively, it's because data science machines are expensive. I mean, let's be honest. I mean,
you can choose. You can have the smaller ones that are cheaper.
No, I mean buying one off the shelf.
Oh, yeah.
And it might be the case that you have one client that you need to do sort of really big data for. You fire this up, you give it all the RAM you need, and you use it for a couple hours, and then you spin it down much cheaper than having to go out and buy that monster machine with whatever.
Correct, yeah. So you may want a big machine now, and then later you'll have a smaller project, and you're just stuck with the big one. Plus, this one can be deployed under the subscription of the client, so it's totally controlled by the client. So they can have their security level, their rights. It gives them a different control over the work rather than you working on your own laptop.
Got it. So the other question is, do you have to like install our server and get it all up to par, or is there a machine that's already prefab?
The data science virtual machines that are available on Azure, they already have this pre-installed. But the big data part of the Microsoft Azure server is subscription based, so you have to pay for it. But there is also the free version, the Microsoft Azure Open, mm-hmm. that allows you to do regular Azure, and that's, it's open and free.
Well, this is fantastic. Is there anything else you want to add? It looks like we've been learning about how to take tons of sort of data, make it a little bit more useful, in terms by windowing and aggregating and doing other things, and by adding, making sure that the signals are mentioned. And then once you have this, you can take that and go into whatever learning model you want to do for either anomaly detection or for grouping or for prediction or whatever.
Yeah. I'll publish a blog soon about this, and so the code will be available there, and I'll show exactly how this can be done. And actually, the signature that you get out of this, the patterns, those are more significant and more descriptive of your data than just using plain column description that is classical for smaller data sets.
Yeah, and effectively you're feature engineering even more useful features to do learning.
It becomes fundamental, yeah. Without this kind of processing, when you have lots of sensors that are recorded over long period of times, the overall description is useless, essentially.
Awesome. Well, this has been super helpful, my friend. We have been learning about how to take your sensor data, make it more useful using Microsoft R Server, even if you have more data than you can handle. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9, and we'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.